Hi guys, it's Russ, back with a bit of an update, as well as a much anticipated new episode of the New Yorker Political Scene. In case you're new here, this is a podcast where I, through the magic of editing, insert myself into the often asinine political analysis show, The New Yorker's Political Scene. Basically, this was a project that emerged out of my frustration from hate listening to The New Yorker Political Scene every week and finding catharsis in analyzing their analysis. I took a break from this show last year following the presidential election, but meant to get back to it this year, though there's been some personal reasons why that hasn't been possible up until now. First of all, I was in Brazil for about a month with my wife, where we spent some time with her family, and then basically loafed around on the beach and soaked up Carnival in Rio de Janeiro. It was really incredible, and I cannot recommend it enough. And then after I got back to New York, I started a new job as a producer at the Majority Report with Sam Cedar. In case you're not familiar, that's also a left-wing news and analysis show that I've been a fan of for years now. And I do have to say, it's been a lot of work, but for once, I'm happy to dispense my professional skills for the forces of good rather than evil. And so, I've been incredibly busy adjusting to this new life as a professional left-wing podcaster, which is why I haven't had time yet to take up the regular weekly schedule of this podcast. And I do have to say, I'm still not at the point where I can make it a weekly thing just yet, but I'm hoping to get back to that sort of schedule maybe later this summer. So please, don't unfollow this feed, and if you're new, go ahead and hit the subscribe button, and then you will hopefully be pleasantly surprised in a few months after you forgot that this show even existed when the next episode drops. But in the meantime, I was hate listening to the New Yorker Political Scene this week and just could not help myself and felt that I needed to put out a new episode just given the subject matter, which is, of course, all of the new reporting, mainly from Jake Tapper's new book, about Joe Biden's declining mental state and the cover-up surrounding it. The New Yorker's episode dropped just days before we learned about Joe Biden's cancer diagnosis, which is sad, sure, but also has had the effect of sort of sidelining what I think is an important conversation about how President Biden's declining mental acuity and the Democratic Party's efforts to cover it up have contributed to a credibility crisis for the party. Now, regular listeners of this show will remember that the New Yorker Political Scene is hosted by three New Yorker writers, Jane Mayer, Susan Glasser, and Evan Osnos, and that Evan Osnos is the sort of House Bidenologist, both for The New Yorker and for CNN, where I also worked with Evan, and Susan Glasser for that matter, as a producer from before the 2020 election through almost all of Biden's term in office. And during that time, Evan famously wrote a book that is a sort of hagiography of Biden, which came out during the 2020 presidential election. So I would often be tasked with producing panel discussions featuring Evan, where he was hailed as an expert knower of all things Joe Biden. An insider, even. But more importantly, Osnos also wrote a profile of Biden in The New Yorker, which came out in March of last year, and that was based mostly on one single interview with Biden in January of 2024, so roughly 9 or 10 months before the presidential election. So basically, during a moment when it could have been viable for Democrats to run an actual presidential primary. And in his article, Osnos included this passage about his assessment of Biden's mental acuity. Quote, "For decades, there was a lightness about Joe Biden, a springy, mischievous energy that was hard not to like, even if it allowed some people to classify him as a lightweight. For better and worse, he is a more solemn figure now. His voice is thin and clotted, and his gestures have slowed. But in our conversation, his mind seemed unchanged. He never bungled a name or a date." Now, in his defense, Osnos did include anecdotes and quotes from Democrats like David Axelrod, who were concerned about Biden's ability to run an effective campaign in 2024 due to his age. But after his piece came out, Osnos also spent months going on CNN and basically repeating that assessment that during his interactions with Biden, he didn't notice anything that would indicate his mental decline. And that is why this week's episode of The Political Scene is so much fun to listen to, because there is a big, giant pink elephant in the room, which is that Evan Osnos actively participated in telling the American people that there was nothing to indicate Biden's declining mental acuity, despite what we could all see and hear with our own eyes and ears. That's why it's so fun for me to hear these brain geniuses revisit all of this now that we have substantive reporting about what was actually happening inside the White House during that time.
Evan, I think as our resident Bidenologist, we do need to start with you. I mean, it must be really something to watch this once again returning to the subject of the last 4 years and to what extent they were the precursor event for this incredible disruption we're living through. First of all, tell us what you learned and have learned, if anything, from all of this, and you know what, how you're feeling about the kind of self-criticism, self-recriminatory aspect of all the journalists weighing in right now.
Yes. Please tell us what you've learned, Evan. We are dying to know.
I think the core of the issue, and this really applies across all of these recent books and forthcoming books, is how much was this a case of Biden and the people around him being deluded, meaning, as Chris Whipple put it, being engaged in a kind of group delusion, a sort of groupthink about willing themselves into the idea that he could win versus an active effort to deceive. And you know, I think part of the reason why the idea of a conspiracy is, frankly, is kind of useful within the Democratic Party right now is it allows somebody like Kamala Harris to then carry on with her political career because she was, in a sense, set up to fail by this arrangement. And it also, in a way, allows the party to say we can draw a fire break between the Biden years and what shall come afterwards.
I'll tell you the other useful thing about painting what's happened now as the result of deception on the part of the Biden administration. It absolves journalists like Evan Osnos from the responsibility of having not rang the alarm louder about Biden's clearly declining mental faculties when 85% of Americans, according to an ABC News Ipsos poll conducted in February of 2024, said that Biden was too old to serve another term as president.
Can I just follow up, Evan? Do you feel deceived?
I think the way that I experienced it is that they were going out of their way, and it was pretty obvious at the time, to make it very hard to cover this guy. So in my case, I spent months trying to get an interview, and the classic over and over again saying, you know, when can we get in? When can we get in? It was only at the point when it was clear to them that we were going to write a giant long profile of this guy, whether or not he participated, that they said, okay, well, now we'll give you 40 minutes or whatever, which, you know, it's like this fight. And so that in its own way was a demonstration of the level of aggressive management and deflection that they were engaged in.
Now, if you've been a regular listener of this podcast, you know that I've been saying for years that anyone with a pair of eyes and ears could tell that Joe Biden was having some serious cognitive issues during his presidency. And I say this not because I had early access to Jake Tapper's book or sources inside his inner circle, but because as a TV news producer, I used to regularly watch Joe Biden's public appearances in their entirety. I wasn't just looking at edited clips here and there, but the publicly available raw feeds of his events. And if you were regularly watching those like I was, it was super clear that Joe Biden shouldn't have been operating an automobile, let alone be at the helm of the United States government. Now, I understand that during that time, Evan Osnos was sending the White House emails asking for interviews with the president, and that they weren't giving him those interviews, and that that must have been frustrating for him. And if the administration's stonewalling really was that noteworthy, why didn't he write it into his piece that came out in early March of 2024?
I think in the end of the day, you have to say that the fact that they limited the access the way they did,
right,
and that there were that Biden gave something like half as many press conferences, if even that, as his predecessors did, and that they attacked reporters who asked questions about his ability to continue on, including Susan's husband, Peter Baker. But they basically, the way they cocooned him, I think, shows that they were not deluded. They understood that he was enfeebled, and they were trying to protect him. And so when they came out and said, he's fine, he's a Superman, there's nothing wrong, they actually were lying. Because if you look at their actions, they were hiding him.
Jane Mayer is right here. But here's the thing. There were plenty of people who never got to interview the president who used their own judgment to say that we were living through an emperor's new clothes style situation. And so it's kind of rich that these guys, who pride themselves on being the best and brightest Washington insiders, are now trying to make it seem like there was this super effective conspiracy that shielded the public from the requisite knowledge to make this determination. As I've mentioned before on this show, Susan Glasser's husband is Peter Baker, the chief White House correspondent for the New York Times. And to his credit, he actually did write critically about Biden's mental faculties when doing so was not so popular in the mainstream media. And frankly, that makes this discussion now between her and Evan Osnos even spicier.
Susan, what do you think? You said something the other day that I remember stayed with me, where you said if this was a cover-up, though, it was the worst executed cover-up because it was playing out in daily life. Every day, anybody who had a television set was watching the deterioration of this president, and we were talking about it in real time on the front page of the newspaper.
Yeah, I think this is the part that gets to this question of covering the White House for us, because in a way, we had the journalists' problem of, don't believe your own lying eyes. The public was very clear for a very long period of time in the Biden presidency that they believed he was too old to serve another term as president, well before the disastrous June 2024 debate. In fact, polls consistently showed like something like two-thirds of Americans, well over 60%, as I recall, in many polls, said that Biden was too old. And yet, in the more insular world of covering the White House, when it becomes a question of, is this thing or is this thing or is this thing specific proof of some specific incapacity on Biden's part, you get right to these questions of what does it mean to write about the White House in this highly polarized age. I think that, there's a fragmentation of media that is an undeniable backdrop to all this. There's the fear among Democrats and their allies in the progressive press, or even the regular old mainstream press, who are so concerned about the prospect of Trump's return. That became a justification, I think, whether it was stated or not, for many people, especially after Biden announced that he was running again. But for me, as you guys know, I always had a different approach. And I think it is worth unpacking why that is. My perspective was, yes, we need to do whatever we can in terms of investigative reporting and find out what we can about the president's condition. But my view was that, and I know this is now the title of the Tapper Thompson book, is Original Sin. My view was that Original Sin was back in 2022 when Biden told others that he was going to run again, and there was no apparent process. And I always thought, listen, we don't need some gotcha, investigation to understand it is an extraordinarily dangerous and risky decision, even independent of the Trump factor, for Joe Biden to have the hubris to say that he's going to run again for president and serve until he's 86 years old. And from my perspective, I knew enough without knowing anything more secret about what was happening behind the scenes in the White House. But I must admit, I was really surprised and frustrated that a lot of journalistic colleagues who I respect didn't have that approach.
Shots fucking fired, Susan. I mean, Evan is probably sitting right there in the same room with her.
If you read the totality of all the different accounts in all the different books, it's also fair to say that many journalists, alike many staffers in the Biden White House, had become too used to the idea of his dwindling capacities. That was a shocking moment. But the truth is, I remember my husband, you mentioned Peter, covering, Biden, and he did write many early stories about the question of Biden and age and how to deal with it.
That's right.
But he went to an event at the beginning of 2024 in South Carolina, and one of his colleagues from the Times was there as well, who doesn't normally cover the president. And, Peter often tells this story because after the event, from the White House reporter's perspective, he's like, well, okay, Biden wasn't great, but he got through it, and he didn't make any major screw-ups. And the guy who doesn't normally cover the White House came up to him and said, oh my God, you know, I had no idea it was this bad. And so to me, again, so we're having a question in a way about covering journalism and the White House. I think that story, Evan, you know, does speak a little bit to our dilemma as people whose job it is to kind of focus on this building all the time.
This is another good point. There's been a lot of haymade, and perhaps there will be less of it now due to his cancer diagnosis, but it seemed like Tapper's book was an opportunity not just for the Democratic Party to look at its decrepit, delusional self in the mirror and have a moment of reckoning, but for the press to have a similar reckoning as well. As someone who once decided to dedicate his life to journalism because of the role it served in the process of democracy, I don't think it's a coincidence that the waning credibility of journalism as an institution coincides with the rise of the post-factual ecosystem we are now living in, where a significant chunk of the country thinks that the 2020 election was stolen, or that they don't see any problem whatsoever with rounding up hundreds of people and sending them to a gulag in El Salvador without any consideration for the Constitution. A lot of liberals say that the rise of Trumpism is the reason for the lack of the public's faith in the media. I would say it's actually the reverse.
What about our responsibility as journalists? Because that's the interesting question here. You know, all White Houses seek to, as you guys have already pointed out, in I think very compelling ways, all White Houses seem to manage expectations. Their candidate is the bestest, winningest, strongest, toughest guy until the moment, you know, that he crumbles, right? And so where is the line? How do we navigate the shifting line between spin and truth when something as consequential as the actual capacity of the president is on the line?
Well, I mean, I think it tells you that the reporter's job is to push harder even when it's unpopular if you think this is really true and not listen to all of the pushback. And most important, just risk your access. And because most of the reason White House reporters don't go hard against the president is that they'll be tossed out of the White House press corps. They'll get no access to anything. You know, it's a real balancing job, but you really have to risk your access and tell the truth if you think that is the truth and pursue it. I mean, and I've written a couple stories about people who were aging and beginning to fail. One, a Democrat, Dianne Feinstein, Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, and another when I was covering Ronald Reagan's presidency. And in both cases, you know, the aides swarm around the person. The reporter is attacked for being ageist and unfair. I mean, on the Feinstein story, I managed to even get attacked by, I think it was Ted Cruz, Republican senators for being unfair to Dianne Feinstein. But it was absolutely true. And it took talking to people in her inner circle and aides who had left who would tell you the truth. And in the case of the Reagan White House, I think there are a number of lessons you can learn.
I just wish I felt like anyone, including the three brainiacs that host the New Yorker political scene, were able to actually learn from any of this. Chuck Schumer is the minority leader in the Senate, and he's unwilling to say that they made a mistake by sticking by Biden. You got a Democratic leader in the House, Hakeem Jeffries, who's saying the exact same thing. For fuck's sake, Andrew Cuomo, who resigned in shame as governor of New York over very credible sexual misconduct allegations, not to mention the scandal surrounding tens of thousands of people who died in nursing homes during COVID because of his corrupt connection to the nursing home industry, is currently leading the race to be the next mayor of New York City. I can't help but notice that we learned none of the things we were supposed to from 2020. The need for paid sick leave, the debt we owe as a society to the so-called frontline workers, the need to have universal health care and profit-free pharmaceuticals, not to mention the end to qualified immunity and mass incarceration. And so, my dear Jane, I appreciate your instinct to point out what we can all do better next time, but I'm just not convinced we have it in us, unfortunately. You might remember that during their final episode before the presidential election, the hosts of the New Yorker political scene framed the election as proof that either America still held democratic principles and values, or, if Donald Trump won, it would mean that America had crossed the Rubicon into authoritarianism and that our self-perception as a democracy-loving people would have to be reconsidered. But then, of course, Donald Trump did win the election, and they kind of just moved on from that whole notion. Like, if we're supposed to learn that democracy isn't an integral part of who we are, Shouldn't we be having a reckoning about, say, American exceptionalism? What is even the point of having a political podcast? I mean, I know why I'm doing it. It's to make me feel less insane, and hopefully to make you feel less insane as well, knowing that we can all see the disintegration of our country and society around us. What's funny to me now, though, is that Donald Trump is president again, so in theory, there are lessons to learn from the last time he was president. For example, how the hosts of the New Yorker political scene might cover his presidency this time around. Just for shits and giggles, let's see what Evan has to say about that.
Well, it is interesting that, you know, while we're litigating the Biden presidency, we, in a sense, we're contending with this in real time with Trump. Look, I've noticed this is a subtle detail, but it is revealing that when clips of Trump are played now on radio and television and podcasts, very often they are these little fragmentary things, or they'll bring down the audio when he leaves whatever ostensible center of the issue. I mean, the key example I'm thinking of is that when he was talking about this incredibly corrupt deal to take a plane from Qatar, they brought down the audio in one of the clips I heard on the radio right at the moment when he started attacking the press. Now, you could argue that the reason he's doing that is that they don't want to give him amplification for this unfounded attack on a free press when the real issue at hand is him taking a handout from a royal family. But it has the effect of also, you know, we've talked about sane washing. You know, maybe this is age washing, that we're in a way giving Trump a benefit of the doubt that he doesn't deserve when it comes to preventing the public from fully focusing on the scale of his deterioration and the ways that his language is different than it was even 10 years ago as we approach the anniversary of him walking down that escalator.
Ah, this is nostalgic for me. It feels like 2015 all over again, doesn't it? The debate about whether to platform Donald Trump, or if you do cover him, whether the clips should be edited and contextualized slash fact-checked, or if they should be allowed to air long and unedited so the audience can see what he actually sounds like. Or maybe we need to use stronger language when writing headlines about him and his policies. I guess maybe that's comforting in a way, isn't it? Because whatever we end up deciding, it's not really going to be of any consequence, is it? Whether the New Yorker writes a headline calling Trump a liar and a fascist, and ultimately, that's what politics is for these people. It's a sort of parlor game. It's fun to think about, and largely inconsequential for their lives.
10 years in, what have we learned about covering this president? One of the things, and this is slightly heretical to say because we spent a lot of time today talking about the individual at the center of it, whether it's Trump or Biden. But when you really step back and you think about what it is that Americans out in the world are making decisions on when it comes to their presidential choice, very often it's the experience in their lives. How is their life going? How much are they spending? How much are they getting the health care they need? How much are they able to achieve the things they actually want in the world? And that is partly related to the decisions of a president. Sometimes it's more or less than the press makes it seem on a daily basis. But that really is the net effect of what a presidency is about. And we shouldn't lose sight. And I think, if anything, having those front pages with these two ideas of equal consequence and significance side by side would be the full report.
Hear, hear, Evan. I'll toast to that. And that is all for this special episode of the New Yorker Political Scene. Like I said, I'm hoping to get back to my regular schedule with the show, maybe later this summer when I'm a bit more settled in at my new job. So until then, please subscribe to make sure you're in the loop when that happens. Thanks for listening. God save Joe Biden. God save all of us, frankly.